Hi, this is Andrew, and this is Keynote, the daily now.tv chat show with some of the world's leading thinkers and writers. Hello, everybody. It's spring. Reason to be cheerful. It's getting warmer, and what better time to be reading books, especially with our literary friend, our great friend, Bethann Patrick, the book critic of the LA Times, and a woman I think who knows more about new books than anyone else in the universe. And Bethann has...
We'll see about that.
Well, you certainly know more than I do, Bethann. And Bethann has graciously agreed to reveal 7 really interesting and important new books coming out in April for spring. Bethann, you've got 3 works of fiction and 4 nonfiction. Let's begin with the fiction. The first book, I Cheerfully Refuse, by Leif Enger, published by Grove Atlantic, also my publisher. Tell me about this book. I actually, and this probably reflects my own ignorance about the fictional world, I'd never heard of Leif or Life. How do
it's
I pronounce
Leif.
It?
Leif Enger. Leif. And Leif, and the only reason I can tell you that for sure is because I actually did my very first author event with Leif Enger in 2001 at a bookstore that no longer exists in New York State. And that was for Peace Like a River. It was a much heralded debut novel. He's written novels since, but I Cheerfully Refuse is truly, it's his best work, and it's really worth everyone's time. This is a retelling of the Orpheus and Eurydice myth, in which Orpheus goes to the underworld to rescue his beloved. And so in this book, we have Rainy, and he is going on a journey on Lake Superior to find out what happened to his beloved wife, Lark. And what's complicating things, it's a near future book, is that Lark is one of the last booksellers left. She's a true believer in reading and ideas. And this is in a near future United States where about 8 families control everything. Several reviews have noted that it sort of sounds familiar from what we've got right now in the United States. But this oligarchy that takes over has made life very difficult for lots of people. And you would think in this near future dystopian atmosphere that this would be a terrible drag, a negative book, and it's not. Its title tells the truth. I Cheerfully Refuse. Enger is a very spiritually driven writer, and I don't mean Enger himself may have some deep religious and faith-based convictions, but that's not what I mean when I say he's a spiritual writer. I mean that Leif Enger really cares about the human spirit and the human connection to our natural world. And that's what he's focusing on in I Cheerfully Refuse. In this book, Lake Superior is sentient. It's done very, very well. I highly recommend this to everyone out there.
And then speaking of lakes, we got a book about gardens. The Garden, a novel by Claire Beams. Tell me about this book. This is, it's described as gothic and horror, is it?
It is. This is a malevolent garden in some ways, but it's actually not the garden itself that's malevolent. It's the humans who are around it. So this is a book that starts with 2 couples. So Irene and George Willard are trying to start a family. And Irene has had 5 terrible miscarriages. She's pregnant again. And in hopes of bringing this pregnancy to term, to a live birth, she has decided that she's going to go to this special place in the Berkshires in Massachusetts, where 2 married doctors, they're referred to first by their married name, but Dr. Bishop, the woman, sort of takes over things. And Dr. Bishop wants her patients, all these pregnant women, to abide by certain rules. 3 of them, including Irene, find a walled garden behind the mansion where they're staying. And they discover that this garden might have some supernatural properties, some really wonderful properties. Meanwhile, And this is the sleight of hand that Claire Bames, and that's how you pronounce her name, by the way, actually plays on the reader, but in a very beautiful way. This is based on the 1940s history of a very odd substance called, let me see if I can actually pronounce it. It's a synthetic estrogen called DES, or diethylstilbestrol. And it was being used because people thought that it would help prevent miscarriages, but unfortunately, it actually caused problems and birth defects. And Bames does not pound this home. This is a gothic and a horror story.
And is it feminist gothic horror?
Yes, very much so. Very much so. And one of the things that I really think is fascinating about it, Andrew, is that it's about how pregnancy creates this power imbalance between the pregnant person and her doctor, her obstetrician. And this is a very strange thing, but I'll tell you, I experienced it myself. I had an obstetrician when I was pregnant with our second child who said, you know, a woman who's pregnant is not fully human. That was just in 1997.
Is there a sort of an Atwoodian quality to this, a Handmaid's Tale?
Absolutely. There's an Atwoodian quality, a bit of an Orwellian quality. Ooh. I would say it also has a very, very large sprinkling of Shirley Jackson, maybe even some Stephen King.
Well, if you like gothic feminist horror, then The Garden is for you. Finally, Leif Enger may be cheerfully refusing, but it's still a rather dark world. The final piece of work, I think, is a little bit more cheerful, a collection of stories by Amor Towles. I've read his Gentleman in Moscow. He's an excellent writer. Tell me about this collection.
Well, I think that, like, as you said, Towles is an excellent writer. I've read all of his books. And in fact, I know I've reviewed The Lincoln Highway. I may have reviewed Rules of Civility at one point as well. I really enjoy his work. It is American in a quite interesting, straightforward way. His previous career before he began writing fiction was in finance. And in a way, I think that informs his approach to characters and character development. He is not really interested in people changing a great deal through a story. What he's interested in is if you've got someone who is truly a character, as we often say, what happens to them along the way when they don't always fit their circumstances? So these pieces, there's the novella and six stories. The novella is called, let me make sure I get this correct. It's called Eve in Hollywood, and it features Evelyn Ross, or Eve, who was in Rules of Civility as Katie Content's friend. And so it's kind of a nice...
Yeah, it sounds quite romantic and... Chip,
yes, it is. Well, you know what it is? It's sophisticated. It's a very sophisticated book. Each story, and let me tell you, they're all set in different places. You know, Eve in Hollywood, of course, L.A.
Is this just for sophisticated readers or do unsophisticated one people like myself? If we read it, will we become sophisticated?
I think it's for people who really enjoy a certain kind of heightened atmosphere, and you will become sophisticated by reading.
If you're aspiring to sophistication, then this is your book, especially
And they're very clever,
clever warm
stories.
Afternoon or evening. Finally, I mentioned there were three pieces of fiction, then four nonfiction, but there's one book, and I want to get to this before the break. There's one book that sounds, one piece of nonfiction that sounds fictional to me, but isn't. It's a new book by Patrice Gagnon, Sociopath, a Memoir. Is this a true story?
You know, it is a true story. And let me tell you, this is someone whose name I don't know how to pronounce. Is it Patrice or Patrish? Is it Gagne or Gagne or whatever?
It's a female, though. That's one thing we know for sure, right?
And, Gagne, the author is a PhD in psychology. She's a clinical psychologist. And she says, look, I was born a sociopath, but sociopathy is something that can be treated. Just because you're a sociopath who doesn't have a lot of feelings, who doesn't experience a lot of the same emotions as other people do, doesn't mean that you have to become a truly bad person. But here's the thing, in this book, and a lot of people are saying that it actually reads more like fiction than like the truth. She is a stable person now. You can tell from reading. Does that mean she's a good person? I don't know. This is not a book about morality.
Is it a bit weird though? This sounds to me like a book waiting to be written.
Oh, I know. It does sound like a book waiting to be written. And yet she, even though she seems to delight in being mischievous and naughty, let me say this. The things that she talks about doing are pretty tame, except for the one time when she was quite young and she stabbed a classmate or a friend, I believe, neighborhood friend, in the head with a pencil. Many of the things she does are pretty tame, you know, having sex with her now husband in an abandoned house, you know? I mean,
well, we've all done that, haven't we? Beth Ann?
You know, I am pleading the fifth, but I will say that it's interesting that she doesn't feel a lot for other people, and she also doesn't feel a lot of remorse. And
yes, yeah. Did she ever knife anyone?
I don't think she ever knifed anyone. I think she's had impulses in her head, because here's what she says about herself. She says, okay, I feel numb a lot of the time. I don't feel the things that other people feel. So it is this pressure, she says, that builds up in my head. And the only way for me to relieve that pressure is to do something, to steal something, to lie about something, to hide something, you know, that kind of transgression. And
do
so
you think that this is the kind of, I mean, publishing business is rather controversial and thin-skinned in many ways. Yeah. Do you think this is the kind of book that publishers were nervous about putting out? I mean, it's put out by a mainstream publisher, and I'm guessing it's going to do pretty well.
I think it will do pretty well, because I think there are so many people, let's face it, we're all self-centered, like the author.
So many sociopaths, especially
so
if
many
you have
sociopaths,
a PhD.
Right?
I think most people with PhDs are sociopaths. Maybe there's a connection between sociopaths and PhDs. So anyone with a PhD out there, you need
out
to
there,
sociopath.
You're a sociopath. That's what Andrew says.
And but, if you want to be a sociopath, maybe you should get a PhD.
You know, that's definitely a possibility. But I will say, this reads very, very well. You feel that you're hearing this story from someone who has made progress. You don't necessarily like her, but it is, I think, very smoothly written. And I think it's a very interesting look.
Is it too smooth, Beth Ann, do you think, or is it genuine?
No, it felt genuine to me. I mean, and that doesn't mean it doesn't feel fictional, okay? So
yeah, well, it's crossing over. We're going to cross over formally after the break to nonfiction. But I want to remind everyone that wonderful guests like Beth Ann Patrick, the LA Times book critic, is brought to us by Liberties, a wonderful new quarterly journal of culture and politics. Going to run a short feature on Liberties. It's published in DC, where Beth Ann lives. I know she knows the publisher as well. And we'll be back in a second to talk nonfiction for April. Don't go away, anyone. If you do, we'll knife you.
News, the noise, there is nuance, insight. Liberties is not just a journal of ideas. It's a meteor of intelligent substance. It's the place to be for engaged citizens. Politics, opinion, substance. Liberties is a triumph for freedom of thought. A quarterly of urgency, of cultural exploration, of intellectual delight, of immaculate prose. It's invaluable. Subscribe now or find Liberties at your favorite bookseller.
You can subscribe to Liberties at libertiesjournal.com. We're speaking with a Los Angeles Times book critic, Beth Ann Patrick, the last book critic, I think, left in the world. The first part of the show, we talked about nonfiction and one book called Sociopath, a memoir, which seems to cross over. And I asked Beth Ann before the break whether Patrice Gagné, PhD, who wrote Sociopath, ever knifed anyone. Apparently she stuck pencils into people, but she never knifed them. Well, one man who was knifed famously was, of course, the great Anglo-Indian, if that's the right way of describing him, author Salman Rushdie, and he has a new nonfiction book out, Knife, Meditations After an Attempted Murder. I know, Bethan, that you haven't been able to get your hands on this book because it's closely embargoed. If you'd read it, the publishers probably would have knifed you. So
there you go, exactly, which I'm sure Sir Salman himself would not have approved of. I want to just point out that subtitle again, Meditations After an Attempted Murder. Reality check, people. This was not just something casual. This man who attacked him truly wanted him dead. And here's the important thing I want us all to remember. I don't think the New York Times, when they talked about the book's release, got this exactly right. They said, oh, the fatwa was lifted in 1998. Well, guess what? The fatwa was rescinded, okay, in 1998 by then it was Mohammad Khatami who was in power in Iran. But a fatwa by Sharia law cannot be rescinded if the person who issued it is dead. And of course, the Ayatollah Khomeini is dead. And so there is no rescinding this. Now, for the government of Iran, they might say, look, we're not paying attention to this, but there are people out there who are not stable, not as stable as our sociopath.
Patrice there are sociopaths out there. Knife-wielding fanatics.
Yeah, so there are people.
In all seriousness, Bethan, you haven't read the book yet. What do you think that Rushdie had any, I don't know what the right word is, remorse or questions about writing this kind of book?
He's
of course famous both for his nonfiction and his fiction. It was Midnight's Children, I don't think it was one of his necessarily best novels, but certainly most influential novels. Mm-hmm. That mm-hmm. created the fatwa in the first place. Did you think
it was actually the Satanic Verses that created the fatwa in the
first place? Oh, right. Midnight's Children is a wonderful book. Satanic Verses is the book that got him his death sentence. Do you think he was a bit wary of writing this book? Is it going to ask for more trouble, more people coming along and trying to knife him?
I think he was very wary about writing this book. He's talked about that quite a bit, that he didn't want to write it. And it's not an easy book to write, but he has said that it's something he needs to get past in order to do anything else. It's a way for him to take charge of what happened and not be a victim.
He was badly injured. Did he
lose
the use of an eye? Was that? Mm-hmm.
And he still has a loss of feeling in his fingertips and his left arm, I believe. He's been permanently changed by this attack. And I think he does have to get through it and write about it. I understand that. We're all waiting for him to be able to write the fiction that we know he can so wonderfully, wonderfully create. I have to also say very quickly that I was able to meet and interview him once when Harun and the Sea of Stories came out. And I found him the kind of sophisticated, there's that word again, and civilized person that this world needs more of. I don't care what you think about Salman Rushdie and his, you know, marriages or his this or his that. He is a thinking person. He is a rational person. He is someone who is devoted to literature. And so this kind of attack, to have his perspective on it is really important, because we may, in all creative endeavors, be facing more of this with more fanaticism in the years to come.
Yeah, I have to admit, I'm ambivalent on Rushdie. He's a Spurs supporter, so I like him for that. But some of his nonfiction work is a little ideological. I wonder whether this book will be ideological.
I think this book is going to be much more personal and much more about what it means for an artist to be used for political statements, but we will see. We will have to wait until next week because I was not allowed to read it.
Well, one book that you've read that you, I know you really love, you've already encouraged me before we went live to get this author.
I don't know if I would say loved, but let's talk about this one.
Well, you found it very intriguing.
Yes.
The States of the Earth, An Ecological and Racial History of Secularization by an author called Mohamed Amer Meziane. It's published by Verso. So politically, I'm guessing it's a leftist or certainly a progressive book. What's the argument in The States of the Earth?
Well, the argument from Meziane is that he sort of places the blame, if you will, for statehood and the way we look at nation states and therefore imperialism. He places the blame on Western Christendom and its imperial attempts. He talks a lot about the Crusades in the early part of this book. And so he's saying, what if the Earth states are actually responsible for the state of the Earth? And that is a huge simplification, Andrew, but it is a very interesting thing to look at and think about as we deal with climate change. You know, have we exported from the West this feeling that everyone has to be a state with defenses and with dependence on fossil fuels? And he's really interrogating the idea of secularization because he actually thinks that secular governments are a good thing, but that what we consider secular in the West is actually a promotion of capitalism. It's not real secularism. It's he thinks that we should have kept, you know, an idea of God or gods, you know, in our, that we shouldn't have separation of church and state completely. But I'm not sure if he fully agrees with me that a sense of spirituality doesn't have to have a great deal to do with faith. He has a long section in his last chapter before his epilogue. He has a section on the word religion and how that's a Western word, a word derived from Western languages and used for Western purposes. But I want to say, Dr. Meziane, he's just really well known as a very young maverick philosopher, okay? I want to say, what about the idea of spirituality and a sense of wonder and how those things need to be encouraged in humans in order to have the kind of governments that we need in this world that is changing so rapidly?
Yeah, and the question I can get him on my show, I would ask him is, I mean, in the 2020s, the state perhaps that's still the most powerful in terms of mining oil or finding oil is Saudi Arabia, which is a hardline religious state. So how would he explain that?
That's part of the thing. That's part of what I found confusing in this book. He would say that Saudi Arabia, as a hardline religious state, has taken its imperialist what's the word I'm looking for? Its imperialist mission from the West. You know, so there's a lot. This is a very left-leaning book. It really places a lot, I think, too much blame on Western culture as hegemonic. And believe me, I am all about Western culture being hegemonic. So
reading between the lines here, Bethan, it doesn't sound as if you... I mean, how seriously should we take a book like this? I mean,
I think we should take it very seriously.
Why?
And I'll tell you why. Because this is a book of deep thought. I don't agree with everything that this author has to say, but he has really done his research. This is a book that actually can make you sit and argue with it, not throw it against the wall kind of arguing, but, you know, almost talking to it, almost thinking like you've got a person right there in front of you. This is a book that actually might be something I believe could help East and West learn a bit more about each other. You know, one of my favorite book titles is T. Karagason Boyle's East is East. And, for so long, we've believed that never the twain shall meet. But I think that in States of the Earth, we could look at why we are so far apart on things and actually realize that secularization is coming. There's another religious movement on the horizon. I mean, let's face it, all of them, you know, are based on various things. I took 2 semesters of early Islamic history as an undergraduate, and it is a very interesting thing to me because it is so recent, relatively recent compared to Judaism and Christianity, and yet it has so much power in the world. I think we need to take Dr. Meziane seriously, and I think we need to argue back.
Well, it'll be interesting to read the States of the Earth and Ecological and Racial History of Secularization alongside the great secularist, yes, Salman Rushdie, whose book Knife, Meditations After an Attempted Murder, is a book about perhaps in some ways, at least I'm guessing, religious extremism and religious violence. Finally, the last nonfiction book that you're suggesting in April is a really interesting one by one of the great masters, the American masters of nonfiction, Eric Larson, The Demon of Unrest. What is it about Eric Larson that makes him such a popular and successful writer, Bethann?
It's because Eric Larson always makes sure that there is some kind of hero in his books. And so it's kind of like, this kind of history, this kind of popular history writing, which Larson is superb at writing, okay? This is not just some, you know, sloppy, toss-off. He, like Meziane, does his research, but you need to have someone to root for. And in this book, you've got a really unusual character because this Major Robert Anderson was actually, he was an army officer. Am I getting that correct? Was he a Marine officer? He was a commander of the forts in Charleston Harbor.
And yeah, well, he was in the Civil War itself. So this is a Civil War. This is nonfiction Civil War.
Nonfiction Civil War. So he was a slave owner. He was a Southerner. He lived in South Carolina, but this is before the Civil War began. And so as a military officer, he was under the command of his commander-in-chief, the very new President Abraham Lincoln. And so when Abraham Lincoln said, all right, we are going to defend Fort Sumter against these upstarts who are attacking it, Major Anderson had to say, even though I am a Southerner who owns slaves and might have a lot of friends who are among these upstarts, I am going to defend Fort Sumter. So you have someone who is not only young and, you know, military, probably a bit dashing, but he's also torn. He's really conflicted between his personal life and his professional life. And so The Demon of Unrest, Anderson stands as that demon in a way, but what the demon really is, of course, for Larson, is what happens in a country before it has civil unrest, because these are the 6 months leading up to the Civil War as we know it.
And do you think, Bethann, that one of the other reasons why Larson is so successful as a nonfiction writer is he brings the skills of a novelist to his subject?
Absolutely. And I think that's something, you know, it's funny, we were talking about sociopath earlier, reading like fiction. You know, Larson definitely writes nonfiction that reads like fiction. And in his case, it's because he knows narrative so well. He knows the pacing of a good story so well. And so when it's time to take a beat, to take a pause, he brings in something else. For example, in this book, there's a woman named Mary Chestnut, who was a Southern lady who kept diaries, and she was an excellent writer. Mary Chestnut's Civil War has been used many, many times in the years since that war as a perspective on women's lives and women's experiences. But Larson brings her in as an example of what's actually happening in Charleston on the ground while all of this foment is occurring. And I think that that is something he understood. We need pauses here. We don't need to just rush, you know, pell-mell into the attack on Fort Sumter. We need to show the buildup. And I just think it's one of his best.
Well, I'm guessing that of all these seven books, this will be the one, perhaps, or maybe Salman Rushdie's Knife, that will sell the best. But
I believe so.
As always, Bethann, I'm going to get you to choose between your children. Select one of these seven books that you're selecting for April. Most of us don't have the time or the reading skills to read seven books in a month. Is there one book in particular that you would strongly suggest for the month?
You know, I would probably go with Leif Enger's I Cheerfully Refuse. I think that is the book that it appeals most to me and to my heart, but it's so beautiful, and it will really speak to many of the anxieties that my fellow readers have.